2 years ago, Hurricane Harvey slammed into our coast, killing 39 people. And a preacher called it God's judgment on Texas for not passing an anti-transgender law. Superstorm Sandy killed 135, and a preacher called it God's judgment on homosexuals and on our government's anti-Israel policy. The 2004 earthquake in Haiti killed more than 200,000 people. And Pat Robertson said, it was because slaves long ago made a pact with the devil. Some like-minded idiot said Hurricane Katrina was God's wrath against gays in New Orleans and casinos in Mississippi. And all the horrors and death of 9/11, said Jerry Falwell, were God's fury at feminists and homosexuals and abortionists and the ACLU. And we shake our heads, and we know better. And we can echo what Jesus says, I tell you, no, no. And yet, these are only the ugliest forms of a primal human impulse that I think lives in most all of us. It's this impulse to try to make some kind of logical sense out of catastrophe. The nastiest version of this is to place meaning in the lives of the victims themselves, whom they say God is surely punishing, who Jesus says, no, I tell you, no. One day news arrived that Pontius Pilate had massacred some Galileans while they were praying. Well, you know, they probably deserved it. They were radicals, and they were lawbreakers, and they were agitators, right? You know, God doesn't hear the prayer of those kinds of people. Pontius Pilate may be bad, but those people, I tell you, no, Jesus says. I tell you, no, and so do we, no. Jesus says, you think God was giving retribution for their sins? No worse than anyone else's? I tell you, no. How about those 18 men who were killed when the Tower of Siloam fell on them? Was God punishing them for their sins? I tell you, no, he says. And we agree with Jesus, clearly, strongly, and rationally, we believe that pain does not equal punishment. But somewhere inside of us, there's this feeling that we cannot help that suffering sometimes comes with guilt. That in some kind of tangled way of our belief and our feelings, suffering is a consequence of guilt. People who suffer often bear the added burden of feeling like they're being punished. Have you ever asked yourself the question, what have I done to deserve this? I have. What have I done to deserve this? Not my fault. I tell you no, Jesus says. I tell you no. Someone long haunted by shame for past mistakes comes to some new understanding, comes to some new hardship, and bears this new hardship under the grim conviction that it's payback. And Jesus says again, I tell you no. It's not your fault. No. And Jesus' own catastrophe proved this point. He would become another Galilean killed by Pontius Pilate while he was praying. This time, crossing out forever this equation of disaster and deserving. It's bad math, y'all. It does not add up. And it's our job to speak up and say, no, no, just like Jesus did. So today, will you finally untether those two? And stop doing that kind of math. Not just for the people around you, but for your own life. It's not your fault. Jesus tells you, no. Pain and punishment do not have any relationship to each other. Please, as we walk towards this cross, put that in your heart. Jesus, after refuting their idea of divine retribution, says something that seems totally out of character and seems out of place. In fact, it stopped me several times when I've come up on this text to preach about it or to teach about it. I kind of skate my way around it because of what he says next. What he says next to them is, unless you repent, you will all suffer likewise. Likewise, you will all perish. And it makes me a little dizzy to hear him say this. You think these victims deserve what they got? I tell you, no, but unless you change, you change, something as bad will happen to you. And so, like I told you, I stall out on this one until I heard a friend of mine, Paul Duke, say something which helps me make a little bit of sense about this. He says that Jesus, he thinks, was doing two things at this intersection. There's two truths here. One, he says that tragedy does not equal judgment. And then he takes that truth like a pancake, plop, and flops it over on the other side and says, well, then the absence of tragedy does not mean that you're doing pretty well either. There's no math here. But then Jesus locks eyes with us and says, us, who are doing pretty well, aren't we? Like the people who were standing around him that day. He asked us to consider that maybe we are now in a crisis of our own that we really haven't recognized yet. While we ponder the meaning of catastrophic events, Jesus asks us to look for the meaning of ordinary days, which, by the way, we have many, many more ordinary days than we have tragic days, don't we? So to help us get a hold of this, to help the crowd around him take this in, he tells a story, which he does all the time. And I love this that he does. This story he tells, we've heard before, we read it in the scripture. Man has a fig tree, produces no figs. 3 fruitless years go by, not one single fig from this tree. Man says to the gardener, it's a waste of good land. Cut that thing down. Now, fig trees in that part of the world are fantastically productive. I don't know if you knew this or not, but one tree can give up to 3 crops every year, which means that this tree has gone 9 harvests figless, just waving its leaves, blowing in the breeze, soaking up sun and soil on this beautiful vineyard. You know, that man's in the business of selling figs. It's how he puts food on his table at home for the kids. It's how he pays to employ the people that help him do this. He's in the fig business, y'all, and all these other fig trees around him are helping him feed his family. Of course, he wants this fruitless, unproductive tree out of there. He really can't afford this good soil to go unproductive. Cut it down, he says. Now, did you notice something about Jesus speaking of human failure here? His image is of a fruitless tree. It's not bad behavior. This tree isn't hateful. It isn't murderous. It isn't lustful. It isn't a heretic tree. Its failure is that this tree stands in the sun on a choice piece of land, drinking up nourishment, but yielding nothing, nothing good. The word sin brings to mind the doing of bad things, but Jesus here turns it around a little bit and seems to say, he speaks of it in terms of doing nothing that matters, which might bring that point more painfully, sharply home to you, because it does for me. Most of us have been set down on a pretty sunny slope in the garden, and we absorb these rich resources that are around us all the time. We pay no attention to them, and we hang on tight to our fortunate place in the world. You know, the unthinkable is to give back no life-sustaining goodness to the world, or to give back no compassion, or no generosity, or no justice, or joy, or witness to the light that is around us all the time and within us all the time, fruitless like that poor tree in the middle of that garden. The tree in Jesus' story that refuses its real purpose now has really no place in the garden. So, of course, the owner reaches for the axe, or he points his help to the axe. But then, you know, the strangest thing happened. The help, the gardener, comes up and says, wait, please, wait. Let's give this thing another year. I'm going to dig around it. I'm going to, with my own hands, put manure around it. I'm going to cultivate the thing. I'm going to pay great attention to it and tend to it for 12 months. And after 12 months of meticulous attention, if that thing still doesn't give us one fig, well, then you can cut it down. What do you say? Well, a man's offer is absurd, a bit absurd. If you, it can have a bit of absurdity. Is there a, I don't think there's a scale of absurdity. Sorry about that. The fig trees there are like cactus or dandelion or like those ash juniper cedars around here. They don't need any care, really. Can you imagine a gardener saying, I'm going to spend 12 months of meticulously caring for a cactus or an ash juniper or a dandelion, which is what this guy is saying here. That here's this crazy gardener, so devoted to one miserably failed tree that he'll lavish 1 year of his life tending to it, giving it care that it really doesn't need, frankly, all in the hopes of seeing it bloom into what it was meant to be. And here there's another twist to the story, because the people standing around Jesus hearing him tell that story were a little bit sideswiped by the ending of that story. There was a fable that went around that ended up in a song that the Peter, Paul, and Mary, or the Pete Seeger, or the Joan Baez, or the Bob Dylan of the time would have sung, that went something like this. Once there was a palm that grew into a beautiful tree and gave no fruit. The owner waited and waited and waited and waited and waited, and still no fruit. So the owner came to chop it down, goes this fable. Please don't chop me down, cries the tree. Transplant me to a better place, and I'll give fruit there. I'll be fruitful there. Well, the owner replies, you haven't done it yet. You never will, and chops it down. That's the fable they're used to hearing. That's the direction they were very sure Jesus' story was going until he throws in that end in there. So sure of how things were going to turn out. How often in your life have you already figured out how the day is going to go? How this hour is going to go? How your life is going to go? Are you leaving any room in your life to be surprised by Jesus? Am I leaving any room for this surprising God and this surprising love? Did you notice there that Jesus changed their conversation also? You know, they were asking, what's the purpose of tragedy? Jesus turns it and asks, well, what's the purpose of tragedy's absence? And then he tells them this story about a wildly generous gardener, outlandishly committed to a useless tree, willing to love it beyond reason toward its own purpose. How much love? And to what purpose? Well, if that gardener turns out to be Jesus, he's willing to die on a tree of our barrenness, all for our rising to bloom into liberated fruitfulness, which is why we're here today, to bloom into liberated fruitfulness.